May it please the court, I'm Eldon Silverman, 3554, and I represent four of the remaining homeowners in a suit that was started by the homeowners in a complaint complaining about the election of a board and the ensuing assessment. There was also a complaint about the fact that the board members had assertedly violated their duties. Many of the unit, parts of the unit, were subject to condemnation by the City and County of Denver as a hazard to health and property. There was a claim, and I don't know that we had much dispute, that through the years there had been some severe deferred maintenance. The HOA answered with a jury demand. There are a total of 8 jury demands. At some point, the HOA moved to amend and said they should have a right because it arose out of the same occurrence as the complaint. They amended to add a counterclaim. The counterclaim was these people haven't paid their assessments and we are asking for a monetary judgment. The court invited the HOA to move to strike the jury. The motion was made, argued, and the jury was struck. Court held a 4-day hearing on the counterclaims, found 6,000 or so plus interest was due from each separate homeowner then subject to the case, and then entered a 54B order. The court determined to defer attorney's fees. Then as the case got closer to a set trial time, recognized that the case was not going to be determined, decided to hold a hearing on attorney's fees over objection, awarded attorney's fees, and we're here today on a consolidated appeal. So my first argument is the trial by consent or jury trial by consent argument. Since all the parties to the action filed jury demands, 6 by the HOA or its board members, and 2 by our side, 1 in answer to the counterclaims, a jury cannot be struck under Rule 38 until there's consent.
So, pardon me, counsel.
Yes.
Is that the case if this is an equitable claim?
That's the second argument, which I don't mind touching on, which is the basic thrust of the action. That's why I mentioned in the beginning that in the appeal, to be allowed to file a counterclaim as part of an answer. The HOA said this arises out of the same occurrence, or out of circumstances as the complaint. The complaint dealt with the issue of an alleged illegal election. It dealt with whether an assessment could issue from an illegally constituted board, and it dealt with the issue of did you breach your duty? We've got significant parts of our units condemned. So you look at the basic thrust of the complaint, you look at it, and that's been the traditional law.
But this case is a little bit different because the initial complaint and the counterclaims were severed. The propriety of that severance is not before us. And so the only thing at issue in the trial was the counterclaims. Am I right about that?
You're right about the fact that it was severed, but I don't think a severance automatically means that you ignore the basic thrust doctrine. Also, it doesn't ignore whether the claim was equitable. I have before me the counterclaim. It's at 166 of the record. At least my reading, there's not one request for a foreclosure. A foreclosure of an assessment is a remedy. Just as when I get a civil judgment on a monetary claim, I have a remedy of a sheriff's sale if I file a judgment lien against somebody's property. So when I look at the counterclaim, I see 7 different causes of action. Each one asks for, this first one against Mr. Dixon, asked for $6,711 plus interest costs and attorney's fees. To go down each of the then existing plaintiffs and separately allege you owe me money. They're all in the range of $6,000. Now, what about the wherefore clause? Many of us don't put much significance. Wherefore, we want our relief. But actually, the wherefore is the relief requested. Here it's requested, and they line it up on page 169, 170. We want this amount of money from this person, and this amount, and that amount. And then they say we pray for attorney's fees, leave to amend to accurately reflect the total amount at the time judgment is entered, etc. So I don't think it is an equitable claim. I think it's a legal claim. But I don't think it changes the character of the case as was determined by the complaint. Now, whether you put much stock in the fact that it was judge-initiated also, not person-initiated, maybe that makes no difference. As to my jury by consent argument, I've already gone through the complaint. I've already discussed the fact that the HOA argued it would be prejudiced if it couldn't assert the claim, quote, arising out of the same operative transaction and occurrences already in this case. That's why I say Rule 15C comes into effect, the relation back doctrine. They had filed an answer. They just hadn't filed a counterclaim. And, of course, the relation back doctrine says it kind of applies to when you started this. And when you started this, you asked for a jury. So I get back to jury by consent. The second argument is that the right to jury trial should have been upheld by the court regardless of the by consent. And due to your question, I've kind of touched on that as to the basic thrust of the counterclaims. The third argument, in direct violation of HOA bylaws, delinquent homeowners were allowed to vote at the recall election, and there's no way to figure out how it would have been different if they hadn't voted. So Judge Lemon recognized in her November 23rd, 2011 ruling, quote, the key factual issue that is dispositive of the counterclaims is whether the board was validly constituted in the fall of 2008 so that its actions, including imposition of the assessment that is the primary subject of the counterclaims. Again, the primary subject of the counterclaims is the assessments, the monetary assessments, were valid and binding upon the association and its members. Section 9.1 of the bylaws provides that only a member in good standing could vote. What was the evidence before the court? It consisted of two major items. The first was the July 2009 accounts receivable of the HOA, showing at least six delinquent homeowners.
Ms. Silverman, is there something in the record that tells us that one or more of the delinquent homeowners voted to retain the board as opposed to those that voted to remove the board?
We don't know one way or the other.
Mr. Silverman, I'll ask it a different way. Even if you assume if you struck six votes, you're still not going to get more than 11. And so don't you need 12 under the bylaws to cause a recall?
You're right.
Well, what does that do to your argument?
It doesn't answer the fundamental question of what an election is about. An election, like we're having a debate tonight, an election preceding the election is a discussion. And as I argued, one of the fundamental principles of democracy is your ability to speak. In fact, the bylaws say if you're being recalled, you have, as a board member, the absolute duty to defend yourself and speak. How do we know the whole idea of democracy is to have views expressed, to allow them to fall upon the ears of somebody who might be predisposed against you, and then they'll either stick with their position or perhaps it'll be modified. Here, and we don't know, there's no record of the meeting, but we know that there were six people who had the authority to vote and also the authority to persuade. So to that degree, you have a difficulty in that you don't know what the outcome would be.
So the bylaws keep the people from discussing as well as voting?
Well, I don't know that I have the bylaws memorized other than I know that discourse, it's a special meeting, is not just to say, please sit down and vote. you call it to order under rule, you know, Robert's Rules of Order, et cetera. So I don't think it's just a blank, here's a piece of paper, please vote.
Okay, I guess what I'm asking is, let's say that I haven't paid my assessment, but I want to put my 2 cents worth in, and I say, well, I haven't paid my assessment, so I'm not allowed to vote, but here's what I think. That's prohibited?
I don't think it's prohibited, but I think it goes to the underlying fairness of an election. You know, the question is, do you redo an election when there's, as I say, this much of a flaw? Or do you just say, well, I think we'll substitute our opinion that it doesn't make a difference? Now, I just don't think that that's what's meant in a small unit of democracy.
Pardon me, Mr. Silverman. Is this a factual issue or a legal issue? And if it's a legal issue, explain that to me, please.
Well, first, we know that a factual issue, it has to be, you know, clearly erroneous. And I'm maintaining that because of the existence of the evidence saying there are 6 delinquencies. As to a legal issue, yeah, it gets to the issue that Judge Boris and I were just discussing, which is, what do you do about a flawed election? I don't think that there's a particular rule that says, oh, you uphold it because you reconstruct anonymous ballots and decide what would have happened if it had been conducted in a different manner.
Have you cited any authority to that effect?
No. Well, yes, I cited some corporate law that says, where a case that was outside of Colorado, say, well, this corporation, you had people voting who shouldn't, and so we're going to order by mandamus or whatever they did, something else. So, yeah, I didn't find any HOA cases. So, Your Honor, let me go on to the argument about the Fortner estate. That's the probate code. Mr. Fortner had not passed away at the time that the assessment was levied. The argument of the HOA is, well, when the estate entered its appearance because of substitution, it should have known the foregoing. Well, that's good for pleadings. You're supposed to know what pleadings there are, but it doesn't work under the non-claim statute, which says you got a year to file a claim, that it's jurisdictional, that it can't be told, it can't be waived. Just because some knowledge is out there in a pleading doesn't cut it in our view of the law. Secondly, under the Mitchum case, the probate court in the City and County of Denver probate court has exclusive jurisdiction. So we ask that that be reversed. And then finally,
What about the statute in Title 15 that gives estates the authority to sue and be sued? And what about the effect of that statute?
It's still a prerequisite that a claim be filed.
Well, but the estate filed a claim, didn't it? It stepped into the shoes of Mr. Fortner.
No, it didn't file a claim. It was the HOA that said, I want an assessment. It's the HOA on the counterclaim. Yes, it filed a It stepped into the shoes
of Mr. Fortner.
Mr. Fortner.
Who was the original plaintiff in the case, right?
Correct. But we have a severed case. And I don't mean that to negate my earlier argument about looking at the thrust of the complaint. I simply mean that it was the moving party was the HOA on the counterclaim. It was the party that had to prove it met all prerequisites.
So are you saying that whenever in a situation like this where you have a living person who files, dies, and then the other side files a counterclaim, you're saying the only place that counterclaim can go is into probate court?
I'm saying, first of all, you need to follow the probate code and do a claim to an existing PR, and Ms. Fortner wasn't appointed till way later. Two, you ask permission. It has exclusive jurisdiction, so yeah, I'm standing on it, but at least you have to have it transferred. You just don't ignore it. You just don't ignore the probate. My final argument, with about a minute to left, totality, is that the attorney fee award should be reversed. We're on a piecemeal appeal. The court did it joint and several. As we know, Section 20 of the Declaration said individual. They could have done it, the court could have done it proportionally by just looking. Each award is slightly different. So, Your Honor, we ask that the case be totally reversed because of the jury. That you give a jury total reversal in that there was an illegal board and the need for an election, or in the alternative, the estate be dismissed, or in the alternative, the entire attorney fee award being found to be premature, no prevailing party's been decided, I reserve my 13 seconds and perhaps ask for a little more. Thank you.
May it please the court. Good morning, counsel. Appellants have brought essentially six issues on appeal, but I think it's instructive at the outset to recognize that, as counsel's oral argument has demonstrated, this entire dispute really revolves around political questions of internal disagreement about the way in which this association should have been run. And as such, it relies, as does the appellants, on the facts. The facts are consume an inordinate amount of the basis on which this appeal is advanced. And we would submit, as the appellees in this case, that the trial court was very careful about evaluating those facts, about listening to the evidence, about establishing the proper grounds for each and one of the rulings that were entered. The burden on the appellants in this case has not been met to overcome the trial court's prudent review of those facts, and certainly not by the standard of review for a factual determination clearly erroneous, that this court must consider those facts in the light most favorable, or at least in terms of reviewing how the trial court made the determinations that it did. The appellants simply have not met their burden to establish grounds for reversal on any of the claims. So let's talk about each of those claims. The first two issues on appeal revolve around the trial court's determination to, upon motion, strike the jury request. I think, as this court has identified, the key element of that, the propriety of that decision, was the bifurcation. The bifurcation under Rule 42, as Judge Bernard has pointed out, completely severed the original complaint from the association's counterclaim. Once that counterclaim was severed from the underlying complaint, it becomes the moving, driving component of that proceeding. It is a separate trial on the association's lien enforcement rights. And as such, the
counsel, maybe you could help me on this. I mean, if what facts need to be proven under a lien enforcement claim? I mean, isn't the lien enforcement claim simply a remedy that flows from you getting a judgment in a particular circumstance?
Well, that's an interesting observation, Your Honor. I think that goes to the fundamental question of whether this, in fact, was an equitable claim in the first place. The association's clear position is that in order to bring its claims in the first place, it must derive that right from some authority. That authority exists in the association's declaration. It is a recorded instrument that binds that individual owner based on their ownership interest in the property. The very fact that that individual has taken possession of their real property, subject to this covenant, this servitude on their property, is the nexus of the association's fundamental claim in the first place. That is a lien interest that is recognized under Kiowa, section 3833.3, 316, and 120, section 123, working together to first create the lien interest on the property, tie it to the owner by virtue of that owner's vested title in that property, and then obligate them to maintain the association's common.
But to prove entitlement to the lien, you first have to establish that there's a debt of some kind. In other words, the homeowners association has to bring forth some proof to say, Joe Smith owed us $300 a month. He hasn't paid it.
That's correct, Your Honor. And that is essentially what a mortgage is. A bank seeking to foreclose on any lien interest.
But I mean, you've got an option, do you not, of suing on the note and forgetting about the lien?
That's an excellent distinction, Your Honor. There is no note in the case of the homeowner association. Even when in a bank situation, there is a promissory note, the bank does have the option to pursue that individual.
Why doesn't the homeowners association have the option simply to say, make these people pay me? We don't want to foreclose their unit. That's a major step. We don't want to do that. We just want the money. So why can't you just get a judgment for $600?
There's no question that the association has the ability to pursue a money claim, a money award. And in fact, it did so in this case.
It sounds like the counterclaims specifically ask for monetary relief, do they not?
It certainly did, Your Honor. Yes, there's no question that the association was seeking a monetary award here. The question is, where does that entitlement to make that demand arise out of? It arises out of the declaration's imposition of that duty in the first place. And that is a recorded document against the property creating the lien in the first place. And to the extent that there was any question about whether the association was actually seeking enforcement of a foreclosure right, that was certainly cleared up the first day of the trial proceeding, where it was made clear on the record that regardless of the language of the complaint in the counterclaim, of the association's counterclaim, that it was in fact affirmatively pursuing and did in fact receive an entitlement to foreclosure. It's in the record, and the foreclosure award is in the judgment. Appellants appear to disregard that fact, but it is nevertheless part of the record.
Also, could you address Mr. Silverman's argument that the severance doesn't necessarily eliminate the need to determine the basic thrust of the litigation or the complaint?
I guess we fundamentally disagree respectfully with regard to that argument. I believe that Rule 15 is the reliance on that is misplaced, because what Rule 15 says is that as subsequent proceedings and filings occur, they can relate back to the original filing. Here, once Rule 42 says is entered, severing that proceed that counterclaim from the other proceeding, there is no ability to relate back. I'm unable to provide any specific authority on that point.
That was my next question. Do you have authority for that? But no.
Unfortunately, I do not, Your Honor. However, I think a basic reading together of Rule 15 and Rule 42 lead to that conclusion. The Rule 42 says that the trial court is entitled to create a separate trial. It is not just a tangent of the earlier proceeding or an adjunct of it. It is a entirely separate trial. And the purpose of that, as case law does demonstrate, is to advance efficiency and economy of the judicial process. And in cases where there are mixed questions of law and equity, it makes sense that the rules provide for a mechanism to separate the legal and equitable claims so that a trial proceeding to the court may occur most expeditiously. In fact, that's what the court recognized in awarding the bifurcation in the underlying case.
And the propriety of the severance is not before us, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. The appellants have not challenged any basis of the bifurcation itself. They only challenge the consequence of that bifurcation, which was the striking of the jury. If I may, I'd go on to the other, briefly touch on the other issues that have been raised. The question as to whether or not the board was illegally constituted relies on an argument that the recall was somehow an election. The recall was not an election. It was just that. It was a recall. It was an effort to take what they've recognized was already a duly appointed board and remove that board. So any failure on the part of that proceeding, whether it was by delinquent accounts that were allowed to vote or comments that may or may not have been made, is irrelevant. The outcome was the same. The recall failed. That meant that before the recall, there was a duly appointed board, and after the recall, there was a duly appointed board. And the trial court actually spent a great deal of effort and time trying to examine the evidence and the testimony to determine exactly what happened in that proceeding, given the conflicting information and the conflicting record.
Pardon me for interrupting, counsel, I'm sorry. And what happened in that proceeding was a question of fact, right?
Precisely. The only authority that the appellants have offered is from out of state, and again goes to the question of an election, the propriety of an election. And that's simply not the case here. The appellants have offered no legal authority for their arguments, their factual arguments, that the recall somehow created an illegal board. The trial court examined those facts carefully, and the appellants have simply failed to meet their burden to establish clear error in that case. With regard to the challenge as to the Fortner estate, as a first position on this, I think it's important to recognize that the statute on which the appellants rely turns on whether or not presentment has properly occurred within the 1 year period. Section 1512.804 recognizes that presentment is simply notice to the personal representative that there is a pending claim against them. I think it strains reasonableness and logic to consider that the affirmative act of that personal representative to enter their appearance in a pending case after that personal representative has been duly appointed and accepts the responsibility of defending that claim. I think this court has recognized that the personal representative of an estate is empowered to act on behalf of that decedent in matters not just in asserting a claim, but also defending an action and taking on responsibility for the outcome of that action. I think the overly narrow reading of a claim is not warranted under the statute. I think it's also critical to recognize that the very statute that the appellants rely on, 1512.803, is not a statute of limitations, as it says in itself, and Section 803, subsection 3, specifically exempts from this entire proceeding claims that advance lien interests, foreclosure, or other equitable claims based on a advancement and enforcement of a lien right. The appellants have been unable to establish that exception to this rule prevents the association from doing, as I said earlier, advancing its lien interest in this case. The association believes that Section 803's limitations and prohibition of proceeding against the estate exclusively in the probate court applies. Appellants have also challenged basically two grounds on the award of attorney's fees against them. First, they say that the attorney fee award was premature, that it was not appropriate to enter an award of attorney's fees based on the proceedings because there is another half of this case pending, essentially the appellant's initial complaint. Again, I think that argument ignores the fact that the case was bifurcated and it created a completely separate trial. Rule 54, under which the trial court entered judgment for the purposes of expediency, a final judgment, the very fact that we're here on an appeal is recognition of the finality of that judgment. As such, attorney fees were entirely appropriate. There's no question that the association was the prevailing party on that underlying case. I don't believe appellants have even challenged that as the basis. Their only challenge is that there's still another half of this case to go, so we really don't know who the prevailing party is. Again,
what remains of that? What remains given the trial court's findings and conclusions here?
Well, that's an excellent question, Your Honor. I'm not sure I know the answer to that question. The appellants raised nearly all of their underlying challenges as affirmative defenses in their defense of the association's counterclaim, and the court found those to be unpersuasive. Whether that is estoppel against them in the underlying case remains to be seen. We would submit that it does, but certainly the outcome of that is entirely separate from the award of fees on the association's singular claims of lien enforcement. And I appear to be out of time, Your Honor. Thank you.
May I be allowed 45 seconds? I think I have 12. Thanks a lot. As to the jury trial issue, counsel says, well, okay, it was a money claim, but at trial we made clear that we really wanted a foreclosure. The jury was struck before trial or hearing. The determination of what is the substance of the complaint took place before a trial, so you have to look at it at that point. Number two, you know, the question that I believe Judge Boris asked me is, were there any legal issues in the election? The trial judge said that the election of the board, there were two board members left after the alleged resignation. As you recall, Mr. Dixon had never resigned. So the judge said the recall cured it. It cured it. Well, as counsel just said, a recall is not an election. So in a sense, it's a legal issue whether deciding whether an election, whether a recall was valid or not is not the same as a new election or a ratification. It was a different issue. I do believe that infused throughout this are legal issues. Jury trial is legal. The election, as I've just described, is legal. Fortner is legal. That is the estate. The attorney fee is legal. So there are some factual issues. So, Your Honor, so I would just ask you to review the counterclaim, and I think it's evident because that's really the basis, is they wanted a jury trial. And so that would reverse the entire case, obviously, the piecemeal case, as I call it. And by the way, you can't discern from the judge's opinion exactly that everything had been decided. In fact, her November opinion says, I just want to give you a highlight, but I'm not prejudging. So that's for another time. The judge clearly said she wasn't prejudging what the amended complaint, because there's a lot more than just what was decided on the assessment case. Thank you.
Thank you for your arguments this morning. This case will stand submitted. We'll get you a written opinion in due course.